Welcome to the Kickstart Podcast, where we highlight the stories of how professionals kickstarted and navigated their very successful careers. My name is Preston, and on this episode, we have the pleasure of hosting someone who has created quite the career for herself. Aside from being a highly sought-after speaker and a recognized author, she's the executive director of the Science Runway, a nonprofit dedicated to inspiring girls to join the life sciences, and is currently the CEO of Cigna, a simulation technology company focused on the how of thinking. Akilah, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to talk to you today.
Perfect. Likewise. For those that don't know who you are, would you mind sharing a little bit more about yourself?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm the CEO of Cigna, where we focus on building simulation technology that helps assess how people think and make decisions.
Wonderful. For people who are curious about how you got to Cigna, to shed a little more color about your background and how you got to where you are now, what did you study at college, and what were your first couple early jobs that you can remember?
I studied neuroscience at the University of Michigan as an undergrad, and it was the perfect setup to what I'm doing today and thinking about how people think, because I was able to dive very deeply into neuroscience, not just from a psychology perspective, but also from a biological perspective. And so my first few jobs were actually in research laboratories, if you can believe that, which was a really great environment to learn a lot of the skill sets that I use today as an entrepreneur as well.
Fantastic. And then I also noticed that throughout your career, you also have experience founding other companies even before Cigna. What did they do? And what were some of your biggest lessons and takeaways from those?
You know, I think some people are just born entrepreneurs and that is their thing. And so for me, that was definitely the case. You know, my whole life, I'd sort of been founding little companies and thinking about how you could change something to make the world a little bit better, a little bit easier for whoever in whatever context. And so for me, I actually didn't found Cigna. I stepped into it as a CEO. And so for me, it's been a really wonderful and fun learning curve to be in this position where I have this really powerful technology platform that I'm excited about and getting to think about how to scale that and how to grow that. It's a slightly different muscle than being a startup founder, but it's very similar. And they're both skill sets that I think I want to have the ability to exercise my whole career.
What I find interesting is that what Cigna does and what you studied way back when in college is almost like a full circle in your career, where you're finally just dedicating yourself to a company with a mission that is, I guess, something that has always been very passionate for you throughout your life. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think for me, I remember when I fell in love with science, I was 8 years old and I was sitting in my classroom in Pennsylvania and waiting for recess. Mm-hmm. I remember actively watching the clock and wanting recess to happen. And then my teacher, who's actually a volunteer, she was a volunteer who came in for an hour a week to teach our science class. And she started talking about microorganisms that live in the Arctic tundra. And that's the only place in the world that they can survive. And I remember thinking, well, if I ended up in the Arctic tundra, I would freeze right away. I wouldn't make it. And that is the environment that's the best for these little microorganisms. And for me, that was a light bulb moment. It sounds like, you know, a small, tiny example of what science can be. But for me, it was, that is the coolest thing I've ever heard about. Who discovered these organisms? What do they look like? Where can I go see them? And is this true of other organisms? And so, you know, I remember I collected random things from all over the playground that day at recess and brought them back and tried to see whether I could create my own little ecosystem in my desk that would have highly specialized microorganisms. I'll give you a hint, that experiment didn't work. And my teacher was very confused at my explanation. But to me at that moment, science was kind of it. And so I knew that no matter what else I did in life, I always wanted to stay really close to that inner scientist.
And that also applied to starting companies on your own as well, because some might wonder, why didn't you just continue the science route, continue the research route, the lab route? What about the starting your own startup really intrigued you early in your career? Like what was the catalyst there?
You know, I love laboratory research. And, you know, to this day, when I look back on some of the best jobs I've had, it is those laboratory research jobs, because I loved the pace of work. I loved the thinking and the intellectual rigor it really takes to succeed in those jobs. For me, I was very impatient to get out there and have a bigger impact. And so entrepreneurship struck me as kind of a way to accelerate the impact that I thought I could eventually have as a PhD or as a professor, but it just felt like a much longer path. And I think earlier on in your career, you're very hungry and you're very impatient.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone says it's going to take you 7 years to complete a PhD, you're like, no, I want to go out there and do it right away. So for better or for worse, I think I was impatient, which, you know, is something a lot of us end up being at some point in our lives.
For sure. And I totally appreciate the honesty. I think you coming from a scientific background and then having that experience, cultivating those and creating those business skills, starting your own company, I think really set up the perfect foundation to where you are now. What was the biggest takeaway that you learned? Were you nervous? Were you scared running your own company from someone doing it for the first time? And what was, I guess, the biggest lesson that you took out from that to help you in your further career that you are now?
You know, I think terror is part of the job of being an entrepreneur. I think that is part and parcel of what it is, because you have this idea or you have this product or you have this technology that is really powerful and you know it. You can feel it in your bones that this is the thing that's going to change the world. And it's on you. It's on you to bring it out there and give it life. It's on you and maybe your co-founders and your team. But it is, you know, that idea is an exciting thing, but it is also something that's placed upon you. And so there is a level of responsibility and I think a level of a fear that all entrepreneurs face that whether we talk about it or not is present for us.
One of the things I want to segue into is we learned that through your previous articles about you, discussions you have, I remember reading about one where you talk a lot about grit and persistence and resilience, a key attribute that not only professionals should have, but also a lot of entrepreneurs should have as well. And I think what really resonated with me is a lot of people, when they think of grit and persistence, is always showing strength and courage in hard times, but grit can also happen as it's a permanent thing as well. It's not just like when things are hard and negative. And so did you always demonstrate, or did you always, were you always kind of, I guess, when it comes to grit and persistence, was it new? Was it a new thing for you running your own company or startup? Or is it something that you've really went through, you were accustomed to throughout your career up until that point? Like, what about resilience and grit really fascinated you as someone with a scientific background?
You know, it's interesting because there's really two parts to that question. One is kind of, where did I get my grit and resilience from? And then the other part of it is like, is it a talent that you can cultivate? And if so, how do you cultivate it? So in terms of me personally, I started my career, as I mentioned, in laboratory research. And there is no place where you learn grit faster than when you are the undergrad that is basically like on par with a pipetting robot. Right? So you come in and it's 300 mini preps to do. And that's a lot of pipetting. That's a lot of sitting in one place and doing the same motion over and over and over and over again, perfectly, with no actionable reward after that set, mm-hmm. right? Like, the actionable reward is you still have your job and you can, you know, keep doing it until you get promoted to doing something more. So I think for me, research was a really great place to learn and hone in on that discipline and find that internal core discipline, which is, even if there isn't a reward at the end of this set of 300 mini preps, you know, tomorrow there may be a reward, or the day after tomorrow, and just kind of build that intrinsic motivation, which mm-hmm. I think is really important when you're a startup founder as well. In terms of learning how to build it, I think one of the best ways to do it is to sort of start building in those rewards for yourself. And that's part of where I think learning intrinsic motivation comes from, is really understanding that if your definition of grit is sending out 200 sales emails a day, right? I'm just throwing that out there as a number. If that's your definition of grit and you're not going to get responses to all of those sales emails in a day, then you need to go ahead and build in some kind of reward system for yourself. Say 50 emails, I'm going to go get a snack. 100 emails, I'm going to go take my dog for a walk. Whatever it happens to be, kind of starting to learn how to build those in for yourself can help you build grit over time.
As well as doing it consistently, I would imagine, as well, day in and day out.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So you started your own startup, and what did you do just after that, after your first startup that found a level of success?
I went to business school. So I had this moment with my first startup company where I said, okay, if it goes really well, I don't know what I'm going to do the day after.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes really poorly, I also don't know what I'm going to do the day mm-hmm. after. And when both of those days started to look a little similar to me, I thought, that's not ideal. I want to know what I'm going to do the day after, and I need to have the skill sets to figure that out. And so I went to business school, which is a great, you know, it's a privilege and an honor to be able to go to business school in a lot of ways. I felt particularly lucky because business school is an opportunity to develop yourself as a leader and really understand yourself in a way that I don't think very many other graduate programs really offer. And I did do a graduate program in engineering prior to that, which was great. I mean, I learned a ton, but it wasn't as much self-development as I think business school was.
Fantastic. That's always a top of mind topic for me, just because the industry that we're in, especially tech, there's a very dynamic conversation about MBA, should you or shouldn't do, what is the true value of going through it? But it's great that, you know, you seemingly have a very positive experience there. You're able to learn, meet, cultivate relationships to help you kind of catapult you further into your career. When did you start your nonprofit?
I started my nonprofit, gosh, almost 10 years ago now, I want to say. And that, you know, came out at this moment where I was invited to a roundtable of women leaders in the sciences. Mm-hmm. And I sat down, I was completely starstruck. I had never seen that many powerful women in the sciences ever in my career. And keep in mind, at that point, I had finished college. I think I'd finished graduate school. I had worked, I had run a company, and I had never seen it. And so, again, this was a while ago, and things have changed in a lot of ways in the ecosystem. But for me, it was dazzling. It was this display of the variety of opportunities within the sciences that I wasn't able to see prior. When I was growing up and thinking about the sciences, I got told, well, do you want to go be in research or do you want to go be a doctor? And mm-hmm. it was like MD or PhD or not. And for me, neither of those options were really a fit. You know, as I mentioned, I was too impatient for the PhD, and I think never could quite decide whether I wanted to do the MD or not. And to me, indecision there felt like a no. And so I was never fitting into either of those camps, and I had never seen what else you could do in the sciences. And so for me, walking into that roundtable that day, I'll never forget it. Some of those women are still my mentors today, and they're amazing. I was completely blown away. And so I went to the organizer and I said, all the little girls in the world need to see this. They need to realize that there are all these different opportunities out there because the traditional path may not fill them. They may not actually fit into them. And we've expanded now to have a broader look at the ecosystem. So we do a lot more work across genders. We do a lot more work in different socioeconomic groups, just to kind of like open it up a little bit more beyond that original idea of like, we'll just have little girls see this. And that's been really fun too. It's been such a rewarding experience to see.
I'm sure it is. I think at the end of the day, it comes from just exposure, right? And just knowing what you can do. And I think if it's just been outlined from day one that you can only do one of two career paths, that's all you'll know. But I think if you have exposure along the way to other career paths, and then at one point or another, it connects with them. And like, wow, this is actually something that matches my skill set, matches my desires, or I'm more passionate in these areas. Now I can pursue these areas thanks to our resources and just programs like this. So for people in the audience that resonate with what you're doing through your nonprofit, the mission, do you do a lot of like workshops or series? Like, where can they find out more information in case that they're curious?
So the Science Runway is actually run through an organization called the Center for Healthcare Innovation. And so they have quite a strong web presence around it. And so I would direct people toward them. I'm very much available through LinkedIn and through my website if people are curious and want to get in touch. Most of the workshops and other programming we run is through Masigna.
Amazing. Perfect. Well, thank you for that more better contextual understanding of your background. Definitely sheds a lot more color in terms of the great things that you've done. Let's shift gears and just talk more about Masigna. So you mentioned that you are the CEO of Masigna. How did you stumble upon the opportunity? What really initially attracted or excited you about it? And if you can just, again, just share the mission behind the company for the audience, that'd be great.
Sure. I think the mission is something that's always attracted me strongly to the company and is part of the reason why I feel so much passion and purpose toward what we're building. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is really around understanding how we think. Most people have a pretty good sense most days of what they're thinking or of why they might be thinking that, but most people don't really think about how they're thinking. And mm-hmm. so if you pause for a second and you kind of try to think about it, you might have a sense of, okay, well, today, you know, I think I've been thinking strategically, or I think I've been really productive, or I have you know, been really in information gathering mode. You might have a sense of it, but we don't in our daily lives really focus on it. But it's really important to actually focus on that. And so at Masikno, we have a simulation technology that within 20 to 60 minutes can actually quantitatively map how people think across certain parameters of cognition. And that can be hugely valuable for a wide array of use cases. So we work with organizations for recruiting. We work with organizations for internal promotion pathways. We work with organizations around putting together cross-functional teams, crisis teams, strategy teams, and so on. All of those require you to really understand not just what skills people bring to the table, which is a really easily spoken about and easily advertised type of thing, but really to look beyond that to see what kind of thinker am I bringing to this table? And is that style of thinking going to be valuable in this particular case?
Mm. I love that for someone that is in the recruiting profession myself. It's very easy to initially identify candidates that have the hard skills that, for example, a company wants. And then if it was that simple, then that candidate would get hired and everything would work out perfect and he or she would be at the company forever and have an amazing career. But really, does that happen? And a lot of times, as you know, people get hired, go through a rigorous process, and somehow there's some sort of disconnect. I think there's a lot of things, a lot of reasons that people will just kind of lump under not a cultural fit, or like something about that person doesn't click. And I think a lot of it has to do with how he or she communicates, how he or she thinks, why they think this way or how they think this way. And I think what Masikno is doing is very intriguing because you're actually quantitatively measuring or showing results to organizations or companies that they normally didn't have access to before, to give them like another layer of just analysis behind a person, behind a candidate, which I think is fascinating. So you mentioned that, again, that you use this technology. There's a lot of different use cases from recruiting and so on. Can individuals use this? If they go on the Masikno site, can they do an individual test for themselves? Is it through like an organization? Is it through a team, in case people are curious about the technology? But, oh, can I try this for myself?
It's typically available through organizations because, okay. And this is the really fascinating part. One of the things that we have found is that individuals who burn out within organizations mm-hmm. sometimes do so because their style of decision-making doesn't align with the leadership style of decision-making. And so there's sort of a fundamental friction that they're constantly running into. And what we find there is that if you're able to bring in people who match an organizational kind of cultural fit and style of decision-making, there's less burnout. And so it's a match also between the hard skills you were talking about, as well as the skills that we look at, the metacognitive skill set layer. And so every organization we work with has different measures that they care about. If they're an organization that constantly faces crisis, for example, they care about our crisis measures. If they're an organization that's very people-centered, they care about our people measures. And so every organization kind of has their own mix of measures mm-hmm. that they really care about. And so for an individual to think about where they might want to fit in best and take a simulation in that lens, they'd actually have to go through the organization to know what the organization is actually looking for.
If a company...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, if a company did not use Masikno, what would the alternative be in the market? Like, in your experience, what are companies doing to try to figure out how or why a candidate's thinking? Or maybe is there no tool out there before you guys?
There are some tools that are used. I would argue, and obviously, you know, I come at it from a Masikno lens. Mm-hmm. These are tools that focus on things that are not the metacognition or the how of thinking, which I think mm-hmm. is the most important aspect of it. So we see organizations using kind of quantitative judgment tests. So, you know, they're kind of what you would think of as like a quantitative assessment. You sometimes see like the triangle and the circle and the square, and you have to put them in order, or those kinds of like logical reasoning tests, if you will. We see those being used. The real kind of issue with them is that even though they can provide a valuable data point, it doesn't correlate to real world performance. So I could be really great in the real world to work with as a colleague, and I could really help the business, but I may just not be good at those tests. And so you'll miss out on great candidates, or vice versa. You could run into someone who's really good at these tests, but doesn't have the right real world skills to succeed within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no correlation between performance on you know, a logical reasoning quantitative assessment and the actual job. And there's no way to do it either. So you can't just take your group and benchmark and say, okay, well, everyone scores, you know, above a 65 in our population. Therefore, we want to recruit for above a 65 in this. Like, there's no actual ability to correlate it to real world performance, which is something that we are able to do. And so that becomes a much more valuable tool, I think, for companies. We also see a lot of psychometric surveys, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which are helpful, and 360 evaluations. And both are helpful. They both help provide context around the candidate. But again, they're both what we would consider slightly biased inputs, because they're either coming into the system with self-reported preferences, or they're coming into the system with reports from people around a person, which once you end up doing that, you end up inviting in, you know, any kind of unconscious biases or any other subconscious biases that the group around that person may have. And we've seen that. Right. So this is where I think we see a lot of candidates who are diverse to the organization in one way or the other really struggling, because we know that their 360 doesn't always match up.
What I'm curious is, if I had a certain level of how I think, I joined, for example, with your organization where the leadership has a completely different way of than what I'm doing, is it very difficult for me to switch how I'm thinking to how the organization or how the majority of the organization thinks? Or is it a matter of, hey, like, you need to use our tool, Miss Signa, to help you just find and attract the people that are aligned from the get-go?
It really depends on the measure that you're looking at. So for example, if you are not people-oriented and you're mm-hmm. entering a highly people-oriented organization, you're going to struggle, because that is such a giant portion of sort of how we make decisions, how we interact with each other. You will really struggle. There are other things, though, that you can, you know, you can diversify your organization with. You can bring in people. So mm-hmm. we look at something called creative decisiveness, which is around your ability to come up with out-of-the-box solutions and charge forward with them. You know, regardless of kind of what the organizational situation is, you're just really strategic about getting your viewpoint out there and, like, making the decision move in a specific direction. That's mm-hmm. a really cool skill to have. Mm-hmm. And we find that that's the kind of skill set where, even if an organization doesn't have a lot of creative decisiveness, you can recruit someone with a lot of it and they can shake things up. And so that's really exciting. But on the other hand, if you're trying to make your organization less people-oriented, I'm not sure why you would, but if that was what you were trying to do, that's a lot harder to then just recruit for, if that makes sense.
Wow, that's super interesting. How big is Miss Signa today as a company?
So we are small but mighty. So we are a under 10 people team right now.
Nice. And then I guess the people that you initially attracted to be part of the founding team, was it through networks? Was it through resources? Context behind this question is, it's no question we're going through uncertain economic times. And I think if I tell founders, if you can build in this market, you can build in any market. And so no matter how big or how small you are, companies that are functioning to continue to move forward and scale, huge, huge respect is given, because it's certainly very, very difficult. And I think especially companies that are very productive, that are hiring intentionally, they're not trying to scale for the sake of scaling. I think that that's wonderful. So I'm happy to hear that you have a lean team and some team that's really backing up a powerful technology that can, of course, influence organizations both big and small out there. So first of all, hats off to you and the team for continuing to build and push forward. But I'm just curious, for people who are fascinated about, you know, recruiting and scaling teams and how a team from zero goes to five, goes to 10, like, how does that happen?
I think all teams have a different kind of story for that. Mm-hmm. On our team, we do our own simulations. So everyone we recruit and bring on board does a simulation.
Amazing.
Everyone does simulations pretty regularly. And part of the reason why is because I want to understand how my employees think. It's the same reason why we sell it. It's really important to cut that understanding. And people's thinking is not static. It changes over time. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we do pretty frequently internally that I think is a great exercise, and I highly recommend other companies do, is we do exercises around VUCAD. And VUCAD are the five elements of stress. And so online on our website, we have two free resources. One is a stress management planner, and the other is a decision readiness quiz. And they both tie into these concepts of VUCAD, and we use them internally quite a bit. So that, I think, is really helpful. VUCAD is volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, and delayed feedback. And the reason why I focus on this is because our thinking patterns depreciate during stressful moments. we all know this. We've all lived this. But as managers and as leaders of growing teams, we sometimes fail to recognize that a growing team has a lot of those stress elements baked right into it, right? You're growing. So there's volatility. There's new players being introduced. There's complexity because as you're ironing out some of those corporate processes that are very easy at an under five team, but become very complicated 15 person team, you have to start to build some real thinking around that. And that's complex. And lastly, you're busy. So there's a lot of delayed feedback. There's a lot of waiting for something that originally you wouldn't have had to wait as long for. And so understand the VUCAT elements and having everyone on your team be aware of it and have a plan for it and understanding what elements bother your team the most can be really valuable as a manager.
Absolutely. What other resources do you provide aside from VUCAT and your main kind of simulation model in case that the audience is curious about?
We have a decision readiness quiz. So this is one of my favorite things. It is a quiz that helps you understand if you're in a good place to make a decision. And one of the reasons why we have that is because we can talk all day long about how people think and how they make decisions. But if you've had a really bad day, you're prone to making a bad decision. It doesn't matter if you are the most exceptional thinker on the planet, right? Like, we are all human. We all react to what happens around us. And so the decision readiness quiz is essentially a little bit of a marker of, are you in a good place to make a big decision? And sometimes the answer to that is no. I think that's a really valuable thing for people to understand, because then rather than spending a lot of their time making decisions and having to unmake them or go back or try to figure out a way to fix the decision, you can stop ahead of time and you can say, you know what, I'm actually not in a great place to make this decision. Let's as a team or as a unit think about ways in which we can push this decision down a little bit. Just let's give ourselves the breathing room. And I think this is particularly relevant to leaders of growing teams, because as teams grow and change and evolve, you're going to have more complex decisions come up and you're going to have more parties and more players involved. And the stress level of everyone on your team is suddenly going to have a bigger impact on the success factor of that decision.
Wow. Your customers, the organizations that use your product, are they primarily larger enterprise organizations, smaller companies, just the general mix?
It's a general mix. It's a really large mix. Yeah, we love the way in which organizations choose to approach Masegna, because I will say no organizations pick the same approach. They all have very different internal thoughts and questions around how they can build it into their workflows. And that's part of what we love, because we really enjoy building it into everyone's workflow in a way where that data layer that you get, the quantitative data on how your company and your organization thinks, can be the most valuable for people.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was wondering listening to you. There's so many use cases for your technology. I was wondering, do you specifically do outreaches based on a recruiting angle, outreaches based on a leadership angle, or is it, do you just have a more of a general outreach, or is it maybe your inbound really healthy because the word of mouth is slowly spreading? How do you get the message out for a product, a technology that can be used for a lot of different ways?
We definitely have a really great stream of inbound requests because, again, the word of mouth around the technology is really powerful. I would say that we also like to reach out to businesses that are going through challenging times, which sounds a little counterintuitive, but for us, it's actually a really interesting opportunity to help at a moment when a business really needs the help. When things don't seem to be going really well, that's actually a great moment to figure out who your best performers actually are. And so there can be value in bringing in a simulation at that point as well. We also, you know, work with a wide range of different sizes of organizations, but it is always, I think, more exciting and preferable when we're able to work with the entire organization. And that's one of the things that scaling has allowed us to do really successfully, is think about working with a whole organization, because now you have this really rich data layer for everyone entering the organization, as well as for every internal promotion within an organization.
So for organization that's interested to use Masegna, what would the initial flow look like? Would they reach out to you normally through your website? And then do they go through kind of a demo of the simulation, and then they just have certain teams, the respective teams, do the simulations, and then what happens?
So typically when we work with an organization, either we'll connect or they'll reach out through the website, as you mentioned. Okay. And the first thing we do is we talk about what matters to their leadership, what matters to their organization to have people be good at. Which of our 80 different parameters of cognition do they care the most about people being good at? And do they think they're the best at? And so very often companies will have a values page or a mission page that goes over the, you know, the seven habits of a blank employee, right? Or the 7 traits that we look for when we hire. We can take those and match those to our 80 parameters of thinking. And that now becomes a really powerful way in which the data layer we're giving back organizations is relevant to their business and relevant to how they think about their organizations. That's our first step, is always assessing and identifying the 6 to 8 measures that matter the most to the organization. And then from there, we get to have some fun. We get to pick a scenario. I love our simulation scenarios. I think they're all a ton of fun. We have scenarios that range from fantasy, where you're in a completely different world with completely different rules, to business case scenarios, to geopolitical scenarios, to some that are just in between. And each scenario is kind of unique. It's a different context. It's a different role. And so we match it up with a scenario, and then the organization gets their own portal where they can go ahead and invite people to take the simulation. And then after that, we have this amazing data layer that we can provide the organization with. We also offer micro learning, which can be really helpful if an organization says, well, we want to stick with our internal talent. We want to promote someone. We just want the data on them. And then if it's not, you know, exactly the right profile, we still really like them. We still want to move them ahead. We'll say, okay, well, we can do micro learning to help them bring up some of their measures so they can perform better when they get to that level.
What are some of the, maybe perhaps, new features, new roadmap that you and team are working on that you could be excited about maybe sometime next year, something to kind of tease the audience a little bit in terms of future outlook?
Oh my gosh, I'm just really excited about everything. I think there's some new things around some of our measures around information management that I'm really excited about. They're not new necessarily, but I think the way we're thinking about them is slightly different. Part of the rationale behind that is we are in an era of exploding information. Mm-hmm. And the simulation's been around for 50 years. And information throughout those 50 years has changed in terms of its velocity and how it kind of lands on people. And so one of the things we've been doing with our latest simulation rollout, and we're planning to continue with future ones, is really studying how people validate and source information. That's becoming more and more of an important part of information management and using information in a great way to make your decisions. And so I think that's something that I'm really excited about. I'm also really interested in some of the research pieces that we're working on right now that have to do with artificial intelligence. Obviously, we have a perspective on AI. As a company that focuses on human decision making, we see what is still lacking in artificial intelligence decision making. And so there's a gap there that we're working on kind of quantifying and understanding better.
Perfect. Thank you for sharing that. And is your team at Masigna, are you distributed? Where are you based out of? Do you have an office?
We are distributed. And that is something that I actually uniquely love about our team, because I tend to work quite a few hours in the day. And as a result, it's nice to have a distributed team where someone is always online and you know, can always work with you no matter what time zone you're currently on.
From the clients that you're working with, from the results data that you're seeing from your product, what are some of the biggest challenges that organizations are facing when it comes to just like the office or hybrid or fully remote dynamics and work situation?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot around productivity and how productivity is measured and quantified. I think the interesting aspect of that is actually around the fact that there's two part participants in every productivity measure. One is the employee who's doing the work, and the other is the manager who's sort of assigning or overseeing that work. And so what we see there is that for an employee to truly be productive, it not only has to come from them, but it also has to come from a manager who's really good at other kinds of measures like task management and so on. So there has to be kind of a nice synergy between manager and employee in order for productivity to really occur. And that's one of the things we're seeing the most, which is that in order to get that productivity, how do businesses look at, how do businesses approach this kind of invisible confound that we see in our studies?
What do you also see from data is like, what is the prevalent or most preferred kind of leadership or management style? I guess it depends on what the organization is doing, what the organization is building, the product, and whether or not they're going through crisis mode. But is there a certain type of management style, leadership style that seems to just work the quote unquote, the best high success ratio in terms of fostering a really strong culture, connection between the management and the employees and the team? Just curious.
I think reducing stress is the biggest thing for leaders, actually. And I think a lot of leaders saw this and experienced this, obviously, during the pandemic. But those VUCAT elements will really, really trip up your team if you're not careful. And it's really easy to mitigate them for your team, but a lot of it does come down to communication and how you communicate and when you communicate and what you communicate. And so if you know you have team members who are sensitive to something like volatility, don't change things on them midstream if you can help it. You know, don't introduce that element if you can help it. Or if you do introduce it, give them the optionality to step away from that part of it, because you don't want to cause stress in your workforce. That's really when everything starts to fray. And so more than a specific leadership style or a specific management style, I would say being really aware of what you're doing to stress out your team and what you can do to not stress out your team. It sounds very simple, but I really think holding on to those VUCAT elements and thinking about them can be very, very valuable. Even if it's something as simple as, you know, we see delayed feedback all the time. Managers introduce it consistently. And I'm guilty of it too, right? Like, it's a very easy thing to do. You're on a call. It's really important. You don't get back to something, but you're not in the office with them anymore. So they can't look over and see that you're on a call and you're busy, but they sent you a Slack message saying that, can they have the rest of the day off because something horrible happened and you don't see it. And so they're sitting there anxious, worried, getting the delayed feedback kind of rising up for them, and you don't see it. And they don't know that you haven't seen it, versus them knowing, oh yeah, they saw it and they haven't responded yet. And so those are the kind of moments where I think as much as you can reduce that for people, the better it is. Like, for example, with my team, I always say, like, I'm getting on a call and I'm not checking my messages for the next hour. So they know. And that's a very simple, small thing, but it does reduce stress, I think.
And I guess, like you said, being aware, being empathetic to the specific individuals on your team. Because I wonder if you had a team of two, that's very different from managing a team of 10 or 20. And what if each and every one of them have scores differently on the product of VUCAT, right? And so it then becomes the onus on the manager to be aware of individual circumstances and then to kind of curate the experience or make sure that they don't overstress that individual or trigger them in a way that they would. So to me, I think, is there like an ideal number of people that people should manage? Or like, is it just about being aware of just the stress on your team? And if you do that well, if you do it adequately, then you can manage a team of 5 versus 10 versus 20.
I think if you do it adequately and you make it a practice, it's really not that difficult. It just takes awareness. So for example, delayed feedback, 9 times out of 10, you can solve that just by making sure your team knows kind of where you are and when you're going to be back online to respond to something or when you're going to review something. It really is just a question of being really transparent about when you are doing what that I think can reduce some of the delayed feedback. If there's an external circumstance that you're not sure about, being honest with them about that can often really help, just because you can say, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to check in and I'll see. But the next checkpoint for this will be Friday. And even if there's still that ambiguity and uncertainty around whatever that answer is, people feel cognitively a lot better if you tell them there's a checkpoint in the future, because they're not like hitting refresh, right? They kind of have that awareness that it's coming, but it's not going to be right then. And people know how to manage that a little bit better than if you just say, I'll let you know when I know. Mm-hmm. That is very stress inducing as a comparison.
So manage expectations, be clear, over communicate, right? To mitigate circumstances like these happening.
And I think for volatility, that does come down also to over communication and really being very, very clear about what's happening, but also making sure that, you know, you are emotionally even keel. That's really, really critical. I think a lot of times there's a lot going on. And so it's very easy to be kind of crisp on Slack one day and then next day have a lot of punctuation and throw people off, you know, like those kinds of things it's things that as a manager, I think you need to be really, really hyper aware of. And once you're hyper aware, you'll bring them into practice. It'll be a lot easier.
It's such a fascinating tool that you and the team has developed. And obviously, as we're filming this end of 2022, which in the tech world, it's a very unique circumstance with just layoffs and layoffs and layoffs happening. It's a very difficult time. So I can imagine, and I can now understand how useful a technology like yours can be for organizations going through this, because it's, on one hand, it's very easy when business is going well, when the economy market's booming, be like, hey, we have nothing to worry about. We don't really have to make an extra effort to optimize in any way. It's really when things are kind of falling apart and when an added level of stress and burden is being afflicted onto the team and to the company, where you could be like, wow, this could be a great opportunity for us to kind of do things a little bit differently. Or this is maybe perhaps where we drop the ball with our team members or how we manage, how we communicate. And by having a solution that provides, just in a short conversation, from my perspective, really, really useful and powerful, impactful data, I can see why a lot of companies would use you. So I think that's really, really, really easy and fascinating to kind of see it from a perspective of, wow, our technology can also be useful when times are difficult. When, if you just Absolutely. Go on the news, that's all you hear and that's all you see.
You know, I think that this is definitely a tough holiday season for a lot of people mm-hmm. with the recent layoffs. And you know, my heart goes out to them. I think that is an incredibly tough situation to be in. But I also do think that, you know, the new year is around the corner and there's a lot of reason for optimism. I think that, you know, we'll see what kind of happens with the economy, but there are still a lot of industries that are hiring. I think tech in particular has been hit pretty hard by the recent news, but there are other industries. And I do get the sense that what's come out of COVID and the pandemic and this mini recession, if you want to call it that, is that people have become more aware of how work can fit into their lives, the meaning work can bring into their lives, and what they want out of work. And I think that that's actually really a powerful, good thing for our future, is for people to say, okay, like, this is how work is going to fit into my life. This is how I can contribute. This is how I can sort of raise the bar in my career. But here's kind of how it fits into the bigger picture. And I think there's been a lot happening recently that can help people get to that place.
Are you, if and when your team are looking to continue to grow and scale, surely people who have been listening to this are by now just intrigued and fascinated by your background, by the mission of Masikna. If and when you do open up additional positions in the future, what kind of positions would they be? And how can people apply if they want to join you on your mission?
We always have this question about kind of who the next hires are and what they're going to be doing. And I don't want to commit to anything yet. We probably will have postings up in the new year. When we think about people joining our team, and it's funny, because we are small, we all wear a lot of hats, and that's kind of just the nature of the game. But that's also, I think, part of how we think at Masikna, is we think very cross-functionally. We think in a very broad way, and we really like that kind of diversity of thought. We also have a very strong learning culture, which I think is part and parcel of, again, what we sell, but it also is who we are. So every year, everyone on the team takes on some kind of learning project. And essentially what that is for us is it's a project where, you know, we expect some failure because it's a big stretch for whoever the person is and whatever the project is. It's a big, big stretch, but we're okay with that. We even look at, you know, we look at our failure points as steps to success. That is a rephrasing that we do internally very, very thoughtfully, because we care about this process of learning and this process of cognitive growth. And so when we hire and we recruit, we really think about, like, who is hungry to be in an environment where they are going to be challenged, but they are also going to learn a ton. And so we really look for people who are willing to take those risks.
Do you sometimes combine your tests, your surveys, your tools and products, integrate with other types of analytical tools or tools that measure perhaps based on personalities or based on other sort of factors to provide a more of a holistic kind of view of a person? Or are you perhaps planning on making a Masikna version of future products down the line to kind of fill in the gaps? But when you approach organizations, are you approaching it as, hey, you can use this as kind of a one-stop shop, or you can combine us with this, and, you know, maybe we vouch for these partners, and if you do our products together at the same time, you know, you can get like a really great kind of result. Do you do that, or is it?
So I think it comes down to the methodology of the products that we interact with. So we know that we're interacting with survey tools. We know we're interacting with 360 reports and internal performance reviews. But the methodology behind a lot of these products is very different from ours in a couple of big ways. So one is the simulation is a non-gameable interface. You're dropped in a novel world with a novel context and a novel role. You're not expected to know anything entering into a simulation. All the information is the information you're given within that world. And so that makes it context independent, which is really huge. It means that people don't actually really know what the right answer is. And that's because there is no right answer. There is no wrong answer in a simulation. It really is about how you think and about how you handle situations. The other aspect of it is that our simulations are built on what's known as a quasi-experimental framework. So as you go through the simulation, things in the world will change and will evolve as a result of the decisions that you have made. However, we keep everyone within sort of the same band of performance, which allows us to compare between candidates. And so that makes it very different, I think, from a lot of the other kind of interview style techniques that are out there, where even if they are behavioral or they are case interviews, there is a human element of subjectivity that goes into it that transforms those interviews from the jump. You walk in the room, you shake hands with the interviewer, and if you make a good impression, you're at a completely different interview now than the person next to you who ran 5 minutes late because their car broke down and they walk in and they're like a mess, right? Like you're in a different interview room, and we all understand that instinctively. But with the simulation, we don't let that happen. Everyone is kind of in the same room because we want to have that equitable ability to compare.
So for organizations or perhaps managers that are listening in on this, like how does the pricing work? Okay, well, like in terms of how do companies pay you? Is it usually through like a monthly? Is it on the back end? If they want to engage with you and they're just kind of curious how that would work or consist of, like any additional insights?
Yeah, so there's kind of two different aspects. There's simulations and there's micro learning. Those are priced separately, but both are priced per user. And so obviously, like every other SaaS company out there, we scale by volume, which should be no surprise to anyone. And then there's a little bit of dependability there in terms of like what measures people are looking at as well, in terms of how long the simulations that they would be deploying are, because some measures take us longer to get information on. People have to play longer in the simulation for us to be able to gather the data that we need.
And people can people do simulations more than once?
Absolutely. So we typically launch our simulations depending on the number of simulations we're launching with an organization, in pairs or in kind of trios that are essentially designed to be different, to be equal, but different contexts. And so people can be in different simulations. And so you can retake a simulation and be in a different context than you were previously.
So for a CEO of a lean but mighty team, Aguila, what does your day-to-day look like for people who are curious?
That's a great question. I'm like trying to think right now because I think my day-to-day changes a lot. I'm a firm believer. Again, I'm going to go back to VUCAD here because it is incredibly valuable. I stress it because it is. I am a firm believer in routines being a really powerful way to knock down volatility, but you need to have flexible routines. So my days always start with a cup of something warm, preferably tea, but it can be a hot chocolate or something else, just because that simple act of like drinking something warm in the beginning of a day can be a really helpful way to kind of ground myself and set in that mini routine that I have every day. So that's probably the consistent factor across my days. I spend a bunch of my time, obviously, with clients, with active deployments, helping them understand what the data they've gotten means, helping them implement programs within their organizations to utilize that data meaningfully. I still get to spend quite a bit of time, which is really nice, like on the actual simulations and understanding the scenarios and understanding the science behind it, which I find really fun and really fascinating. That's kind of my research laboratory time. And then, you know, obviously a lot of time with my team, both on the technical side as well as on the marketing side.
What you said about routine piqued my interest. How important is routine to decrease volatility and stress?
Very. So volatility essentially is feeling like your life is out of control. Mm-hmm. And so what we find is that if there are small things that you do every single day, even if your day-to-day looks very, very different, and mine does, it truly does look very, very different every day, getting started with a simple routine in the morning or at some point can be a really great metacognitive checkpoint for you as well. So one of the things that I also tell a lot of people is, you know, if you're not in the practice of thinking about how you think, that's okay. Most of us are not, but you can start. And so that might just mean sitting down every morning with a cup of tea or, you know, walking your puppy or whatever it happens to be, but taking a few minutes to yourself to say like, okay, how am I thinking today? How, what are my priorities? How do I want to think about my day? And start to think about the metacognition behind that in a way that I think can be really instructive in terms of shaping what you want to get done that day and maximizing your productivity.
I can totally relate. I just completely off tangent, but similar to you, I enjoy tea very much, and tea and even just doing what I can to go to the gym or work out every morning at the same time. I don't do it just for the endorphins. To me, it became like the anchor of my day.
It really is creating that anchor.
And just like you said, it created that space where I can just plan out my day, just zone out. And I completely underestimated what would happen to me psychologically if I just stopped that routine. If I could travel, if I wake up late for some reason, it just the whole day just feels affected. And I can see how, whether it's something small in the morning day or a couple routines throughout your workday, how powerful that can be just compounded over time.
Absolutely. The other thing that I'm a huge fan of, which I'm sure will be a little controversial, is I like to do a Sunday evening checklist for the week, because I find that if you launch into your work week Monday morning, no clue what the week is going to bring you, that to me is very stressful, right? I feel like I'm inviting chaos. But if I can get 15, 20 minutes on a Sunday night, I'm rested, I'm refreshed mm-hmm. from the weekend, I can sit down and like write down everything I need to do Monday morning. Monday morning, I can feel like I'm on autopilot. And it's much less stressful than waking up on Monday morning and be like, okay, where did I leave things on Friday? What's going on here? Rather than going through that, I'm a huge fan of Sunday evening to-do lists. And I actually send it out to my team as well. So we have like a team-wide message that goes out with like priorities for the week. Always on Sunday night. It is never a Monday morning thing for me, because I think it's just helpful people know where they're headed.
I too love to plan the next day, the night before, including Sunday night. So that's something I totally, and I think you can apply that to everything from caps of wardrobe to what you eat during the week. It's like finding opportunities to just make less decisions, right? And because the more questions, the more chaos, the more stress it can cause, even on a small scale. And so, again, I can totally resonate with that mission. But Akilah, I really want to thank you so much for being able to just share a little bit about your background, some of the exciting things you're working on at Masika. Certainly, it's very, very obvious in terms of the amount of impact and value that Masika, your resources, the tools, the simulation, the microlearning can do for organizations, both big and small. So I'm personally just very, very excited to see where you and your team go, continue to grow, future products that you continue to roll out into the future. And typically, you know, for podcasts like these, one of our favorite ways to end it is just by asking you for people in the audience who hope to follow in your footsteps one of these days, whether it becomes accomplished professional, maybe it's a very successful CEO or someone that's just done a great job and taking chances and navigating their career in a wonderful way, what would your one advice be?
You know, it's hard to boil it down to one piece of advice. I think it depends a little bit on where you are in your career. So I had the opportunity to do a mentoring session actually with the Science Runway. We were asked for our advice, and it was, you know, kids who are in high school and college and very young. And my advice to them was that the calendar doesn't lie, and like, you can't buy time. And so it's a really valuable resource that you have a ton of. But obviously, the older we get, the less of that we have. So, you know, that's not necessarily as applicable to an older audience or to the older members of the audience. But I think being really aware of what your goals are can give you a huge running start and learning how to make your goals actionable. So one of my favorite things to do in the last 2 weeks of December, which is when we're recording this, and into early January, is to pick a word that sort of summarizes up my intention for the coming year. And I think that that's really helpful, because that word typically helps inform the goals and strategies that I come up with throughout that year. And that to me has been really, really powerful. Whether there's been years when I've picked words that to me are more focused around finding balance in a particular year, or whether there are years where I've picked words that to me are really about, you know, intellectual curiosity or a skill that I want to build out, really thinking through what the goals are can make a huge difference, because I don't think enough of us actually take the time to do it. It's something we talk a lot about. It's something we, you know, see countless advertisements around, you know, set your intentions and set your goals and make your New Year's resolutions. And we don't really do it. And I find that even the simple act of forcing myself every year to sit down and like write down, okay, what are my goals this next year, is really helpful. Some years, I'll admit, it's painful to look back on because we have not hit the goals, but it is always a worthwhile exercise. And so I think understanding what your goals are at any stage in your life is really important.
Well, on that note, I hope you do have an opportunity to not only set a wonderful, ambitious goal, but to also be able to accomplish it next year. I think a lot of people are very hopeful for 2023 to be an okay year. And there's no doubt in my mind, I think you and your team have set yourself up for success and wonderful continued accomplishments down the line. So Akilah, thank you so much again. And lastly, for people who wanted to reach out to you directly, if they have any questions, advice, where can they find you?
LinkedIn is the best place.
Perfect. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. We will certainly keep in touch, Akilah, and shout out to you and the team at Masika. And we'll be watching and rooting for you from the sidelines.
Thank you so much. This was really wonderful.
Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure you subscribe for other great stories that are coming up. If you need any help with hiring, know of anyone who's looking for a job, or would like to be a guest on this podcast, please feel free to reach out to us at www.kickstartfinder.com. Really, really appreciate it, and we'll see you on the next one.